Group meeting, Saturday, 12th March, 1988. Now we work considering certain things in the Upanishads last time. But before we go on with where we stopped, I want to say just a few things. You know, the Jews expected the Messiah. They did not think of the Messiah in terms of a great prophet, a religious teacher. The word means, the name means, a prince who will be the leader. The Jews were looking forward to this Messiah, the prince who would be leader, who would once again establish Israel as an independent state, victoriously, and so forth. Now, it struck me rather strongly, only 2 days ago. Can one be the Messiah to oneself? Remember, this idea of the Messiah as leader, as a victorious prince, is also the liberator. Ordinarily, one might say, oh, impossible for me, the person in the world, to be a Messiah to oneself. And yet, for those of us who are concerned with religion in the deep, in the profound sense, which means living the religious life, which is no other than the human everyday life lived virtuously, for us there is a specific meaning to my saying that one can be a Messiah to oneself. The Messiah's task, the Messiah considered as the prince who is the victor and who overcomes all enemies and establishes oneself as oneself, ruling over one's whole self. You see? Now, the enemies for each one of us are all the obstructions in our own psyche which prevent the light of transcendence from shining through us. Now, whosoever, therefore, can live the religious life in the full sense and realize full-fledged humanness, he is indeed the prince who is the victorious leader. Note how the Buddha said, when he was questioned by Upaka on the way to Kasi, he said, "Victorious I am over all evil." He used the term victorious. Now it's rather strange that he who insisted upon such compassion and understanding that he would sacrifice his own life rather than hurt anybody else should use the term which is used by your military genius who wins a victory over the enemies of the state. But he used that term, victorious. And if he can transpose that meaning of victorious to our own life, we can see a meaning in being the Messiah to oneself. Because thereby you have realized your full-fledged humanness, insofar as you have cleansed the temple, which is the psychophysical organism. It's completely cleansed, and therefore transcendence itself realizes its own transcendence in terms of humanness through you, the particular person. Now, it seemed to me, when this just suddenly came like that, that is a very practical, logical way of looking at the thing. We don't have to shirk our own responsibility. It is our own responsibility so to live that oneself, the psychophysical organism which bears our own name, becomes, through purification, the perfected Holy One, and thereby manifests transcendence. I don't know how that appeals to you, but consider it. Don't start thinking about it in the ordinary way in which we think, with lots of pros and cons as regards what is presented. Consider it in the true meaning of the word consider. To examine studiously in the light of that inner light within ourself which shines constantly in the darkness. You know, you can link up St. John's beginning. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was God, and the Word was with God. And he goes on to say, the light shineth in the darkness. What is the darkness? Just myself. My own imperfect psyche. You see? And in its purification, through its purification, that light comes into full consciousness. Do remember, you become clearly conscious of this. And this term which the Buddha used, clear consciousness, has very deep and profound meaning. It doesn't simply mean looking at something sensibly, logically, and so on. You see, there is no argument about it. It is the state of consciousness which is pure revelation, and pure revelation is wordless. It is therefore thoughtless and feelingless, because we are aware of our thoughts and feelings in terms of language. I am feeling sad, I am feeling excited, etc., etc., or I think this, that, or the other. Well, the brain is talking away. In that transcendent state, the brain has stopped talking. It doesn't talk anymore. When I am silent, as I put it in this very book, when I am silent, the King speaks. Well, now, let's go on to the Upanishad says, he was afraid, he referring to the Atma. I would always say it, not he, for the Atma. Therefore, one who is alone is afraid. This one then thought to himself, since there is nothing else than myself, of what am I afraid? Because, you know, if you remember last time, I read that first first paragraph of the fourth chapter of the fourth section of the first chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, in which in the beginning there was only the Atma. Looking around and seeing nothing other than himself, he said, I am. Which of course is an absurd, linguistically that's absolutely absurd. Because if you look around and you don't see anything at all, how do you even know yourself? Because when you see another self, then you are aware of yourself as looking at another self. But then these are the insuperable difficulties of thought and language where the state of revelation is concerned. Thereupon verily his fear departed, for of what should he be afraid? Assuredly it is from a second that fear arises. Now, when one reads that in the Upanishad, one thinks of a second as just another person. It is not the fact of another person or another thing which is meant here by second. What is meant really is that we, constituted as we are conscious of ourselves and everything of our total environment in that particular way, where everything outside my skin is other than myself. I am unaware of the relationships, the intimate relationships between myself and the rest of the universe, actually. This is what is meant by the second, the word second. It's our state of consciousness. In Buddhist terms, vijnana, discriminative consciousness, analytical consciousness. You can't analyze, you cannot discriminate unless you are conscious in terms of otherness. This is something different. But the consciousness of otherness is responsible and has been ever since man came on the globe for all the conflicts and miseries that have afflicted mankind. As the fundamental error, the fundamental sin, if you like, to be conscious in this uninclusive way, this exclusive way. You and I, two different people. That is how we are conscious. And we are conscious in that manner because our particular sense functions deceive us. When I look at everybody here, I think of everybody here, you see, as separate, different bodies. And you think of me as Firoz, as a different body. That can't be helped. We are constituted like that. Dear Mother Nature, in evolving us, couldn't evolve us with a brain which could transcend the illusion produced in terms of otherness. That is what we as intelligent people have to deal with, to grapple with, one of the very important things. And if one can grapple with that alone, completely and perfectly, one becomes a messiah to oneself. You are liberated. What is this fear? It is a two-way fear. One way before Atman realization. The other, in the returning to discriminative consciousness, as mentioned in the previous paragraph. With respect to the former, the realization of Atman means that the Holy One must step out of his spaceship of mind into spaceless, timeless eternity. Our consciousness, which is so intimately related with mind, it is the faculty of knowingness by the mind. That's what consciousness is. Consciousness. Conscire, scire, to know, the Latin. You see, it's the faculty of knowingness. And this faculty of knowingness awakens, comes into operation in any case, only when we are attending to that which produces our sense impressions. If I'm walking on the pavement and I'm completely absorbed with some problem in the office or whatever it is, I don't notice another person walking towards me. I may bump into him. You see? But if I can pay attention, or if my attention is aroused by that other person saying, hey, or coughing or something, then I'm aware of the other person walking towards me, and I don't bump into him, and so on. Now, so it is a case that the Holy One must step out of his spaceship of mind into spaceless, timeless eternity. Because if you ever get even a touch of that consciousness, actual consciousness, not a belief or a thought or an idea, of consciousness as such, the consciousness of eternity, all otherness vanishes completely. That doesn't mean that you will lose your sense functioning power, which will enable you to know that there is a car going 60 miles an hour and I better not step on the road in front of it. It won't prevent you. The organism will function in its normal way, and at the same time the super consciousness will also function. To plunge out of the last vestige of the familiar into the unknown is the moment of truth, the total unselfing possible to the Holy One. Because in that moment of transcendent consciousness, consciousness of the eternal, the infinite, then there is no separation. And that is the moment of truth. The moment of death in its immortal resplendence, the unknowable other life. You see, I put that in, this was years ago, in 1965, it was written. The moment, the total unselfing of the Holy One is the moment of truth. It is also the moment of death in its immortal resplendence. We have curious ideas about death. Again, due to the way our senses function, and the way our psyche is conditioned, therefore, particularly possessively, and therefore we feel a sense of loss, and so forth, you see. But death and life exist in simultaneity, just as in eternity, past, present and future exist in simultaneity. But because we are not conscious in terms of eternity, but are discriminatively conscious in terms of time, which is the shadow of eternity, we feel the separateness and therefore the loss of that which we had before. But I've explained this on a previous occasion. No growth is possible. The very fact of growth means that one has died to the existing condition and is reborn immediately into the new condition. You see, in India, I think there are some groups which think of reincarnation and rebirth as immediate after death. I dare say possibly some holy one or some genius really penetrated into this, that the very fact of existing means from moment to moment that you die out of this moment and are reborn in the next moment, because you don't lose your self-consciousness. The association of the I am I with the very next moment means the rebirth of the I. You see? In that sense, yes, reincarnation and rebirth have a meaning. But otherwise, the popular conception that some mysterious bloke inside this body is the fellow who will be born again in another body, that's all nonsensical. At least I say so. Don't believe a word. Consider it. So, there is fear. It is quite unlike fear when a rock in a raging sea shivers your ship, or when the child of your heart is ailing. Recall the waking up when you dream you are falling through space. I have experienced that myself. You are falling through space, and one wakes up in a fear. The panicky clutching for safety, the fear of the nowhere, the nothing. There again, if one realizes holistic consciousness, the nowhere is actually the now here. I mean, you just put a hyphen between N-O-W and H-E-R-E, and nowhere becomes now here. Language is a strange thing. It's a wonderful thing in so many ways, and it's a rather deceptive thing in so many ways. Only he in communion who has crossed into nowhere from the point of no return has feared divinely. How strange this fear is. The Holy One, giving himself wholly to the unknown, suddenly trembles. Quick! Grasp that supreme to be known, and fear shall be no more. Because when you enter the deeper and deeper states of consciousness, there comes the point when you totally leave. This is the what is called sometimes the crossing of the abyss. You totally leave all worldly consciousness. You see? And you want to hold on to the glimpse of the transcendent which you've had. But death stands shining invisibly. Truth is no object of desire. Unseizable is transcendence. Naked plunge. The Holy One, taken up into that one, realizes death, the other life, as no other than life. Heaven endures constant, and fear is not. Yajnavalkya, the great teacher of the Brihadaranyaka, he was called the prince of yogis, Yogeshwara. Ishwara doesn't mean prince, it really means the god of yogis, Ishwara. Yajnavalkya the Yogeshwara affirms, that Atma is not this, it is not that. It's the famous Neti Neti doctrine. It is unseizable, for it is not seized. You can't seize it, because you can only seize that which is other. But the Atma is not other. It is the absolute all. Just as Brahman is the absolute all. The Brahman is the objective term, Atma is the subjective term. It is indestructible, for it is not destroyed. It is the alone, associateless, unattached, for it does not attach itself. The transcendent, the ultimate source, the origin, cannot attach itself to anything. It becomes everything, minus attachment. It is unbound. It does not tremble. It is not injured. Really, those old people, they were absolutely marvelous in some ways. Mind you, they said some funny things too. Funny, peculiar, not ha-ha. Now, transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation. And I mean conjugation. The Holy One's awareness of this in communion, he translates as world creation. Because all change, all manifestation, all existence, existence means a standing out of, a being different, is the result of the ceaseless creative activity of the creative power of transcendence. You see? So, heaven, transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation, perpetually creating. You know, there are times when, in the quiet, if you ever have the good fortune to enter into that quietness, that stillness, that silence, in the quiet, you suddenly realize this perpetual creative activity of the creative energy. In ancient days, this was spoken of in the common terms of common creatures, exoterically. The few learned and discovered the inner meaning. Now, the Upanishads itself talks in straightforward animal terms. It first describes the separation of the sexes. At first, he, the Atma, was as a man and a woman combined, all in one. And then, he caused that very being to fall apart into two parts. From that arose the sovereign lord, Pati, the Sanskrit, meaning also husband, and the lady, Patni, meaning the wife. Therefore, this, oneself is like a half fragment, as Yajnavalkya used to say. Therefore, this void is filled with the feminine. Because minus the feminine aspect, the negative aspect, so-called, of the actuality, there could be no creation, no manifestation possible. He, the sovereign lord, conjugated with her, the lady. Therefrom were produced beings with intelligence. Manushya is the Sanskrit word. And manas is mind. Manushya means human beings. Then I have written something whose meaning I have quite forgotten. In the static undivided, there is no creative action. Wisdom by itself is non-moving. It lives only through love. Without wisdom, joy of love degenerates into destructive lust. But when poised by the power of wisdom, joy of love is the bliss of creative action. No, I did understand all that. Desire divine, free of binding consequence. Creative activity by transcendence has no consequence whatsoever for transcendence. Whatever we think, feel, speak, do has consequence attached to it. But there is no consequence where transcendence, where God, Brahman is concerned. No consequence whatsoever. The blissful state of peaceful union, timeless and deathless. This is the true meaning of karma. Not karma. Karma, K-A-R-M-A, is action, creative action, because its root is kri, meaning to create. But this is K-A-M-A, A with the grave accent over it, karma. Karma is desire. And this desire is the thing that first stirs transcendence itself to enable creative energy to get going and produce manifestation. And this is the true meaning of eros. Our English word erotic, for instance, has only the so-called non-moral, shall I say, meaning attached to it. Erotic. But that's nonsense. Eros, karma, is the power that bestows immortality upon all the gods. And this comes out in the Greek pantheon too. It is Eros who bestows immortality upon the denizens of Olympus. And you know what Olympus means, the name Olympus. The name is allied to our word lamp, the light, the shining light. Creative action is play, and play means interplay. I should have said actually implies interplay. Where transcendence and the shining void intermingle, there rises the stir which is desire, mystery. This desire is mystery. It can never be known intellectually by analysis, for mystery cannot be dismembered. But the pure one, the Purusha, can participate in mystery with loving action, which is unifying understanding. You remember last time we talked about Purusha, meaning the person, Purva, Pur, and Usha. Usha to burn up. The burning up of all evil-mindedness. And mindedness is emphasized because everything starts with the mind. Desire starts with the mind. And then the intellect sets to work how to fulfill that desire and so forth. In timeless conjugation, life, other life, the male, female, rest in the undifferentiated unity of unmoving action. Now you might wonder what on earth is unmoving action. Creative action produces no movement whatsoever. It produces manifestation, but it is manifestation in terms of the archetype, the thought in the mind of God, as the Trismegistic writings put it. You see? And that is unmoving. When movement comes into play, actual motion, rajas, the rajastic, rajasic quality as we call it, in Hindu terms. Then there is disturbance. Then there is disequilibrium. Otherwise, there is perfect equilibrium. Remember Sri Krishna's words in the Gita? He who sees action in inaction and inaction in action, he truly seeth. This inaction in action, what is this action? Creative action, giving rise to the archetypal forms. Desire is the power that draws the severing line between male and female, and which awakens to differentiated self-existence in a unity of creative interplay with the other. And so the whole universe, psycho-spiritual and psycho-physical, is put in motion. And that's how life comes into being, because life is movement. There is movement then. I'm afraid these early chapters in this book are too concentrated. This male, the sovereign lord, and this female, the perpetual feminine, are all powerful archetypal forces. The conjugative union of this lord and lady is the primordial marriage made in heaven, and from it flow all the archetypes that man has named. In our own personal lives, the psyche of a man has its anima, its female counterpart. And the anima, the psyche of the female, has its animus, its male counterpart. That is, as conceived by the particular man and the particular woman, each man has a particular feel about what woman is. And each woman has a particular feel about what man is. You see, and this feel is spoiled by all our conditioning. That is why in the old days, in the very old days, of course, there were no novels. But after novels came to be written, the sages forbade their disciples to read novels. Because novels play the very devil with our psychical love life. It is the wellspring of energy, prana, the river of life, okeanos, that encircles the world. The Greeks called it okeanos, which underlies the divine sanctifying that upholds heaven and earth. The great sacrifice spoken of in the Upanishads and other scriptures. The emanations, visarga, comes in the 8th book of the Gita, that word, which is the action, karma, that causes the birth of beings, that is, of the archetypes named devas, gods, angels, and human beings. I don't know why I didn't add "and human beings." I wrote it. Now, let's go on. Thus have arisen the cosmogonies of past ages. Emerging as they do out of a religious consciousness, they have inevitably taken shape in part as theogonies. Cosmogony is the birth of the cosmos. Theogony is the birth of the gods. Theos and goni is the word which relates to the birth. Thence religious minds proceeded to construct corresponding anthropogenesis, having given rise to a cosmogenesis, they produced their anthropogenesis. The creation myths of the world are replete with this wonderful maya, these charming illusions which are the colourful shadows of the one reality. The Upanishad proceeds, "He knew, the Atma knew, I indeed am this creation, for I emitted it all from myself. Thus, he it became creation. He who knows this as such comes to be in that creation of his." The significance of the teaching is clear. In Atman realization, the state of pure awareness being, Sat-Chit, there is no differentiation. In the returning to ordinary discriminative consciousness, differentiation sets in. The brain of the Holy One, in accordance with its conditioning during studentship by the socio-cultural heritage of the day, produces the conceptions and thought forms of the spirit, of the spiritual or of the psychic world. He emits it all out of himself. He becomes it. He is it. Thus the shapes of the hosts and forces of the celestial and archetypal worlds are all the creation by the Holy One and not creation by a postulated entity named God. The theistic religions, I think they have made a colossal error in saying that God created the archangels, angels, and all the rest of it. They are his conditioned interpretations and many mind forms which are born out of his primary man form, Purusha Vida, which is the all form. You find this difficult? It is difficult to follow. But look, those of you who have a copy, just read it quietly. Take it sentence by sentence and let the mind brood, the brain brood in quietness. That is the important thing, just brood over it. Let it speak to you. And as it speaks to you, as the ideas come, your brain is talking to you, note them down, just leave them aside. Then later on, look at what you have written. You see? And again brood over it. You will find it will change and change and change until perhaps you might get that lightning flash of transcendence out of it. Difficult when you have to work for your living 25 hours of the day. A little farther on the same Upanishad, we see evidence of the conditioning influence of the socio-cultural environment of that age. And the Upanishad just describes how the four great castes were produced, how dharma, the religious teaching, was produced, and how law and order were produced. You see? So we'll leave that.